Hey, true crime besties. Welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to an all-new episode of Serialistly with me, Annie Elise. I hope you guys are having a good week so far. I'm probably about to ruin it with all these case updates and new cases I have to share with you. But before we get into all of that, I did want to just let you know, you might be noticing that the cover art has changed a little bit. The reason why, long story short, is before we had on the cover art, the cereal was emphasized because, of course, Serialistly is a play on the word cereal, like serial killers and things like that. But apparently I made a few enemies at the New York Times and they thought that I was trying to make it a spinoff of their series, Serial, because they're the ones who own the podcast Serial. And so we had been talking with them trying to make it work to where, you know, we could have the podcast name that we want, and we told them out of all of the reviews we have and everything, nobody's ever said that they thought that there was a tie to cereal. But anyways, we settled on changing the cover art so that the cereal wasn't emphasized and that the new name of the podcast would technically be Serialistly with Annie Elise. So that's why you're noticing a change in the art. Not that it matters, but still wanted to address it in case you're like, oh, what's going on, Annie? I miss the old art. I miss it too, guys. But we're just trying to make everybody happy over here. We're not trying to make enemies with the man, if that makes sense. Okay, so we have a lot of cases to talk about today. New, old, existing, all the things. I want to start with the Madeline Soto case, because if you have been following that, you know that there have been some updates that are coming out. Madeline is the little girl who went missing when she was supposed to go to school. Her mom reported her missing later that day. She had never showed up at school. Come to find out that the boyfriend was involved. There were allegations that he had been sexually abusing Madeline for years. He was also caught on CCTV dumping her school backpack and I believe her school laptop as well, and it just wasn't looking good. Then when they seized his devices, they found all sorts of explicit child material involving Madeline on it. And I mean, it was pretty obvious that he was the one responsible for her disappearance and for her murder, because her remains ended up being found. But weeks and weeks went by and there were no charges. But officially now, Stefan Stearns, the boyfriend of Madeline's mom, was officially charged with murdering her. Now, unfortunately, there aren't any other details other than he's been charged, and the prosecutors have not said whether or not they will seek the death penalty, but once there is more information, I will definitely keep you guys updated. We also don't know if the mom is going to be charged with anything. She hasn't at this point, but a lot of people think that she is complicit, that maybe she didn't commit the murder, but helped him with the cover-up, because there was some weird stuff going on with her interview. Her stories weren't really matching. And again, because the sexual abuse had apparently been ongoing for years, people are like, how couldn't she know? Was she complicit? Did she allow this? Which, I don't want to shame her. She is a victim in this, in my opinion, in the sense that she's a mother and lost her daughter. However, if she was complicit, my opinions, of course, change. But I think that there are many times where somebody can be being abused in a house and other people in the house don't know, so that's not to shame her at all, but we'll find out if she did know, and we'll see if she is charged as an accessory or any sort of conspiracy or concealment, cover-up, any of those things. So stay tuned for that. I also will put in the show notes the full episode I did on this case so that you can get caught up, but a million trigger warnings, guys. It is beyond horrific. Now, with that, I kind of want to go into a case that makes me very, very happy, and it's about disgusting, creepy rapists who are finally getting the punishment that they deserve. Because Glenn Sullivan, a 54-year-old man from Louisiana who repeatedly raped a 14-year-old little girl and impregnated her, he is going to be physically castrated while serving a 50-year prison sentence. This is all part of a plea deal. According to court records, Glenn had groomed this 14-year-old victim, and he also used threats of violence against her and her family, also that he could keep her quiet. I mean, truly disgusting, truly sick. Then, when she was pregnant, DNA evidence proved that he was the father of the child. So he pled guilty on April 17th to 4 counts of second-degree rape, and he agreed to be surgically castrated as opposed to chemically castrated, which, let me just say, when I first saw this headline, I was like, wait, this can't be real. And I like clicked into it. I started researching it. It is. I was like, why isn't that the rule of thumb for all rapists? Why aren't they all castrated from the jump? I just feel like it makes so much sense. Not only so they can never reoffend in the future if they're let out, but also so they can't reoffend in the prison with other inmates. You know what I mean? So I was really pleased when I saw this. It probably made me more happy than it should, but it did. Now, the district attorney in this case said, and I quote, "Sex crimes against juveniles are the most malicious crimes we prosecute. I intend on using every tool the legislator is willing to give us, including physical castration, all to seek justice for the children in our community."
Many of us have heard of chemical, but when you talk about physical, exactly what does that mean?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Of course, we're talking physical this time, as you said, unlike the chemical. I've had probably two or three, I think, over the course of my career, chemical castrations that are ordered. And what that entails in the state of Louisiana is a scheduled administration of shots throughout the remainder of the defendant's life that he has to go in, he has to report, and he has to voluntarily intake. And if he ever were to take testosterone or steroids to counteract those injections, then that would be a new charge and he would go back to prison. Mm-hmm. For the case of physical castration, we're talking about a surgeon surgically removing the defendant's testicles from his body. So Glenn Sullivan has lived in Livingston Parish, to my understanding, his whole life. And I can tell you he is what we call a longtime offender or a career defendant. He has constantly been a part in the justice system as a defendant. Mm-hmm. And this particular crime that he's committed is just so egregious and so heinous. The raping of a 14-year-old girl, which led to her being pregnant. Now this girl is raising this child. I mean, she has to live with this the rest of her life, you know, with this child that I'm sure she's, you know, going to love and she's going to raise. And, you know, I really commend her. She was able to actually finish school, get her high school diploma, and she's really making something of herself, and I'm proud of her for that. And Mr. Sullivan, just being the lifelong defendant that he is, committing such a horrible act to this young girl, I think he deserves every bit of this.
It just makes me so happy. I feel like, finally, that is good justice. That is, I appreciate when people go to prison. Don't get me wrong. I can appreciate, like, all of the things. But, like, that is just true divine intervention, if you ask me. Speaking of divine intervention, guys, I want to talk to you about Suzanne Morphew, because I have been long awaiting this day, and you'll understand why. Now, as a reminder for those of you who are not very familiar with the case, Suzanne Morphew is the Colorado mom who went missing while she was out for a bike ride back in May of 2020, specifically on Mother's Day. Her husband Barry had been arrested, which I will get into in a minute, but then he was released and the charges were dropped. But Suzanne died by homicide. This according to an autopsy that was released on Monday, April 29th. Now, if you haven't heard of this case before, I will link a podcast episode about this case in the show notes as well, because this one is so wild. I mean, from the jump, I definitely thought that her husband Barry was involved. There were so many shady things he did, such as his cell phone activity out on the property that day that she went missing, the weird trip to the hotel, which then reeked of chlorine, then it was like the papers he brought to the hotel, like nothing was making any sense, which he ultimately ended up being charged, but then the charges were dropped, which we talk about all of that in the episode, and I'm going to talk about more of it in a second here, but I have just been like waiting for justice in this case. So Suzanne's body ended up being found almost 3 years later in September of 2023 when investigators were searching on an unrelated case in Moffett, Colorado, which is about 90 minutes south of where Suzanne lived. So her death was determined to have been caused by homicide by undetermined means in the setting of butoprolol, azapirone, and metamidine intoxication. Now, I know that those were a mouthful, guys, but I'm going to break down what they are. So the El Paso County coroner said that these drugs are marketed as a compounded injectable chemical tranquilizer, a tranquilizer for wildlife. And they said that there was no indication of trauma to Suzanne's body at the time of her death as well. Her biking clothes were found with her remains, and in addition, the autopsy noted a, quote, weathered bullet that was found with her remains. However, the autopsy said that her feet and her shoes were missing. So like I said, Barry Morphew, Suzanne's husband, was charged with her murder back in 2021. but those charges were dropped in April of 2022, just before a trial was supposed to begin. Now, at first, when the charges were dropped, people were saying that it was because her remains hadn't been found yet, and they were waiting until everything, like, froze over so that they could thaw the remains once they did find them, all of these things. But his daughters have been standing by his side from day one, saying he absolutely would never murder our mother. We believe in his innocence, which we'll see what happens after this. Kind of feels very Chad Daybell-like, right? But anyways, those charges were dropped in April of 2022.
We've been silent for a long time, and we've decided that we finally want to break the silence.
This morning, just days before the second anniversary of her disappearance, the family of Suzanne Morphew is speaking out for the first time since the murder charges against her husband were dropped.
It's been an emotional roller coaster, but we feel like we can finally take our first steps in healing, which is a blessing. And yeah, we just know our dad better than anyone else. And we know he was not involved in our mom's disappearance.
Mallory and Macy Morphew, standing by their father, who investigators believe was responsible for their mother's disappearance 2 years ago. The three, seen walking out of court arm in arm just moments after the charges against him were dropped.
We want to heal. We feel like we haven't been able to heal these past 2 years.
The family says Suzanne left her Colorado home for a bike ride, but never returned.
I just love my girls. And I love my wife. And I just want her to be found.
But investigators told a different story, arresting Barry Morphew. The charges ranging from first-degree murder to tampering with physical evidence. Prosecutors argued that Morphew discovered his wife was having an affair, then murdered her, disposed of her body, and staged a bike crash in a rural area. Releasing this body camera footage from the hours after she was reported missing, police saying Morphew touched evidence.
Hey, could you not touch the bike with your hands, please?
Morphew's daughters say he isn't a killer and are celebrating the dismissal of the case, now demanding District Attorney Linda Stanley should do more.
I just hope that Linda will step up to the plate and do everything she can to find our mom, because what they've done is not fair. And we're never going to stop looking for our mom.
Court filings say that while authorities are close to discovering Suzanne's body, weather has complicated the efforts. The location where Suzanne's body is believed to be has 5 feet of snow concealing it. But the family's attorney says authorities have mishandled the case and are planning to file a complaint against the DA.
And if you want to honor Suzanne and you want to honor the daughters, go find Suzanne.
The DA's office telling ABC News they and law enforcement have been diligently searching for Suzanne Morphew since she was reported missing, and that they are continuing to do so.
Prosecutors need to be held responsible, and they need to pay for the damage they've caused to Barry, which is frankly nearly irreparable, because it's hard for anybody to believe that Barry is not who they claim he was.
Now, the family spoke out this weekend. It was Suzanne Morphew's birthday, and her daughters say, of course, they wished they were spending it with her. The charges against Barry Morphew were dismissed without prejudice, which means that if investigators do uncover new evidence, those charges can be filed again, Michael.
But now, the fact that she died with animal tranquilizers in her body has a lot of people remembering about a certain detail in Barry's history. And we covered this in the other episode, which again, I'll link it all in the show notes. But good old Barry has a history with tranquilizers. Specifically, during a search of the Morphew's family home after Suzanne disappeared, law enforcement officials reported finding a tranquilizer dart gun and empty darts, and a needle that was used to inject tranquilizer chemicals into the darts. They also found a cap that was used to cover the injecting needle in the clothes dryer at the home. And what else was in that clothing dryer at the house? Bed sheets and clothing. So at the time when that was found, people were like, oh, he 100% tranquilized her, and then he forgot that he had the cap and it came off in the laundry. Now, prosecutors believed that on the afternoon of May 9th, 2020, Barry loaded a syringe for a tranquilizer dart, put his phone on airplane mode, then shot his wife Suzanne with the dart. He then chased her around the house until the tranquilizer took effect, and we talk about this in all of the various phone pings around his yard. Now, here's what Barry has told investigators in interviews over the years about his tranquilizer gun, his darts, and the chemicals. This all according to the police affidavit when he was arrested and charged with her murder. Barry first told investigators on May 28, 2020, that he kept the darts in the home, all in order to tranquilize deer, to then transport the animals and to sell them. But he said that he only ever used it in Indiana, not in Colorado. Months later, in March 2021, Barry also told investigators that he used the darts to shoot and tranquilize deers so that he could cut off their antlers. And he said that he might have tranquilized two deer at his home in Colorado in late April. Then he told investigators he was afraid of getting in trouble with wildlife officials for the practice, and that's why he hadn't mentioned it any earlier. In April 2021, Barry then told investigators that he uses what's known as the BAM formulation. It's a mixture of the three drugs that were also coincidentally found in Suzanne Morphew's bones, and that he said he used that formula to sedate deer. He told investigators that he bought the chemicals in Indiana and that he kept them on his workbench in vials. He said he mixed the chemicals into darts himself rather than using a licensed veterinarian. When investigators asked whether he could mix the tranquilizer without help from anybody, he said, "Yeah, absolutely." However, investigators didn't find any BAM formulation or tranquilizers in Barry Morphew's home after his wife Suzanne disappeared. One investigator asked Barry in April of 2021 whether he might have thrown those tranquilizers away in one of the five, quote, trash runs that he made in and around Broomfield on May 10th, 2020, which was the day after Suzanne was reported as missing. And he said to that, "Could have been." Yep, feeling like he has an answer for everything. And guys, this is why I'm telling you this case was so crazy. There was so much shady crap. The trash runs, the hotel. So you definitely need to listen to that full episode. So he said, "Okay, yeah, could have been." And now you might be thinking, "Okay, well, what about that tranquilizer needle cap that was found in the laundry room?" Well, Barry admitted to investigators that it did look a little suspicious. A little suspicious that a tranquilizer needle cap was found with bedsheets in the dryer. Saying, quote, "Because it looks like if I did something and ripped the sheet and got blood on them and then ripped them off and washed them, to me, looking at it through a detective's eyes, you would look a little suspicious." Yeah, dum-dum, you think? Now, during the interview, he said that he was confident that there was no evidence on the sheets, saying, "I'm just being open with you. Obviously, things line up against me, coincidentally or for some reason. I mean, look back and see some of the things that happened and like, wow, gosh, that makes me look. It makes me think that. Why would God allow that? Those things in the situation to make me look like the sheets, the bed unmade, all these things." Kind of spiraling, being like, "I don't know why all those things are happening. They're all making me look bad. It's kind of weird that the sheets make me look bad. It's unmade. It's this. It's ripped." But it's like, no, it looks that way because, in my opinion, you did it. And you made a lot of mistakes along the way. Then during a separate interview in April of 2021, Barry said that he had no idea how that tranquilizer needle cap got into the dryer. He also denied using the tranquilizer gun on May 9th, 2020, when Suzanne disappeared, which is the day that Suzanne was last known to be alive. And he said, "It's got nothing to do with me. I hate that because, you know, it just makes me look bad." Being like, "Oh, it's everybody else. It makes me look bad, but I'm innocent. I had nothing to do with it." Now, Barry's attorney previously said that the tranquilizer gun was broken when the authorities discovered it after Suzanne's disappearance. And she also screened body cam footage in the court that showed the county sheriff's deputies stating that they didn't believe that a tranquilizer gun that was found in Barry's gun safe functioned. But then, Barry changed his story yet again. This time, he said that he sometimes shot deer in the backyard from his back door. He also admitted that he sometimes shot the tranquilizer gun from a little breezeway between the garage and the laundry room. Which, let me just say, how convenient, since that breezeway was also close to the area where Suzanne was last known to be alive. She had been sunbathing right behind their home. She also sent a selfie to her secret boyfriend around 2 p.m. on May 9th, 2020. And that photo is the last time that investigators can prove that she was alive. And it's been suspected that he knew that Suzanne was about to leave him, so did he come home, he saw her send this selfie, did he just like fly into a rage, or had he already been planning this because he knew that she was going to be leaving him? But here's another weird detail. Barry put his phone into airplane mode at 2:47 p.m. that day. And Suzanne never responded to messages from that guy that she had been texting, which were sent at 2:44 and 2:46 p.m. So as I mentioned, Barry's original murder charges were dropped, and you would probably be wondering, like, how? Look at all the evidence against him, which that's what my thoughts were exactly too. But since then, Barry has doubled down on his innocence, going as far as to sue the prosecutors because he believes that he was wrongfully charged.
In the statement, Barry Morphew's attorney with a call for action. What needs to be done instead of pointing fingers at Barry Morphew is asking the officials about the number of missing people and the number of human remains that have been recovered in or from Sawatch County in recent past. And Barry Morphew's attorney concluded with this statement. When law enforcement focuses in on one person and refuses to review evidence objectively and fairly, it is a disservice to the community and creates exactly what has come to light. Years of unsolved murders, end quote. A defense attorney clearly on the offensive there.
And ever since Suzanne's body was found, Barry and their two adult daughters also accused investigators of not telling them whether they tested the bullet or the clothing for any DNA evidence. And according to Barry's lawyers, they've also spoken out and said that her autopsy results do not implicate Barry at all, and that he's still innocent. They said, Barry Morphew is innocent, and he could not have killed his wife. She got up the morning of Mother's Day. She had her cup of coffee. That is now confirmed with the autopsy report, because, side note, caffeine was found in her body. It's also confirmed with the autopsy report that she put on her bike clothes. She was on a bike ride and abducted. The tranquilizer that was found in her bones, allegedly, is a very common animal tranquilizer that could have been used on farms or by hunters, which are people who are very prevalent in that area of Salida. Salida is where Suzanne went missing. Which, let me just say, I get attorneys need to defend. That is their job. I don't know about all of that. It seems like a huge stretch that, coincidentally, the same compounded tranquilizer that Barry used, that he tried to lie about using in Colorado, then finally admitted to using maybe once in Colorado, was also found inside his dead wife's bones after she disappeared, when his cell phone was pinging all around the yard chasing her, when he also had a dart cap that was mysteriously left in a dryer. I mean, come on. So my question here is, will there be an arrest and more charges to come down the pike for Barry? We don't know yet. Personally, I hope so, because I truly believe that Barry killed Suzanne, allegedly. And this seems like even more proof that he did do this. Plus, when he was first charged, investigators had not found Suzanne's body yet, if you remember. So I know murder charges can be filed without a body, but I do think that Suzanne's new autopsy results would be key in getting a conviction against Barry, and so maybe that's why they've waited to recharge him, to add new charges, all of these things. And I'm just wondering, are the daughters still going to stand by his side through all of this, now that this is out, now that this autopsy result has been made public? It's not looking good for Barry. I, again, have thought he was guilty from day one. I could be wrong, but I really don't think I am, and I'm interested to know what you guys think. Now, let's talk a little bit about Karen Reed, because Karen Reed's murder trial is officially underway. Opening statements and testimony started on Monday, and they continued through Thursday. However, the court did have the day off on Wednesday, and they're restarting today on Thursday. But as a reminder, Karen is charged with second-degree murder in the 2022 death of her boyfriend, who also happened to be a Boston police officer, John O'Keefe. He was found in the snow outside of fellow Boston police officer Brian Albert's home in Canton, Massachusetts, and it has been shady from the jump. Prosecutors say that Karen hit John with her SUV, while Karen says that she's been framed, and this is a huge, wide-ranging cover-up. Now, if you're interested in the deep dive on this case, I will link an episode of everything up until the trial in the show notes below so that you can get fully caught up as this mega long trial goes down, because I think it's going to be 2 months, they're estimating. But what's so fascinating about this case is everybody is asking if it's a cover-up and a conspiracy, which very, very rarely do we ever see that in mainstream media. They're always usually very careful to not question if there's a cover-up or a conspiracy, and it's on every single header of every news channel. And I think that is very interesting and kind of speaks volumes about this case, in addition to the fact that so many people are outside of the courthouse advocating for Karen, saying, free Karen, free Karen. She's been framed. This is all a cover-up by all of these officers. And I'm going to keep it real. The evidence is pretty damning. Not necessarily the evidence against Karen, but the evidence that this very well could be a cover-up. So definitely listen to that episode. I think it's one of the best performing episodes we've ever put out because it is that wild of a case. Now, during opening statements, prosecutors said that a cracked taillight and Karen's own words to the first responders when she says she hit him proves that she's guilty, saying, "The defendant, Karen Reed, is guilty of murder in the second degree, striking the victim, Mr. O'Keefe, with her car, knocking him back onto the ground, striking his head on the ground, causing the bleeding in his brain and swelling, and then leaving him there for several hours in a blizzard."
From all of those people within that house that evening, none of us at any point in time observed John O'Keefe come into the house. They see the vehicle out front, they see the vehicle pull away, and they just assume that they left, and no one was coming.
Now, the defense had a far different story, saying Karen Reed was framed. Her car never struck John O'Keefe. She didn't cause his death, and that means that somebody else did.
You will learn that there are other major problems with the Commonwealth's theory. You'll learn that when John O'Keefe was found, he did not look like he had been hit by a car. You'll learn that he looked to have been attacked and beaten up. You'll learn that John O'Keefe was a large 6'2" man who, if positioned behind a Lexus SUV, would have had his torso completely exposed to the rear of that vehicle, including to the taillight. You'll learn that no part of his torso was injured. There was no bruising, no ridges, no scratches, no punctures. You'll learn that his chest and hips and legs were pristine, despite the Commonwealth's contention that he was hit by a 6,000-pound vehicle. The evidence will show that what was not pristine was his right arm. You will take one look at that arm, and you will conclude that a car did not cause those injuries. The injuries to John O'Keefe's arm appear to be consistent with scratch marks and claw marks, marks that make it look as though an animal had attacked his arm. But you won't have to rely just on your common sense when you look at those photos. You'll hear from an expert forensic pathologist who is world-renowned, who has personally conducted thousands of autopsies. And he will testify that those marks are consistent with scratch and claw marks and bite marks from an animal, including a German Shepherd. You'll learn that on January 29th of 2022, Brian Albert's family dog, Chloe, was a German Shepherd. You'll learn that Brian Albert has admitted that this dog is not good around strangers. You'll learn that on January 29th of 2022, John O'Keefe would have been a stranger to that dog. And you'll learn that Chloe had been the beloved family dog for the Alberts for 7 years. The Albert family loved Chloe. But strangely, as we discuss this dog today, the Albert family doesn't have its beloved Chloe anymore. You will learn that there is no competent evidence that Karen Reed's taillight shattered at Brian Albert's property in the early morning hours of January 29th, 2022. To the contrary, you'll learn that when Karen left John at Brian Albert's house, she drove back to John's house on Meadows Ave across town in Canton. At John's home, where he lived with his two adopted children, Karen was drifting in and out of sleep, but she woke up for good in a panic sometime around 4 a.m. because John hadn't come home. And that was not like him at all. He had never done that before. Karen had a sinking feeling that something was wrong. Something was seriously wrong.
The first witness in the trial was John's brother, Paul, who described having to rush to the hospital that morning and also overheard Karen screaming, "Is he alive? Is he alive?" Paul said, quote, "He was pretty banged up, and what really stood out to me was the eyes. It was as if there were ping pong balls under his eyelids." The second witness to take the stand was Paul's wife, Erin. She testified about the Aruba trip, saying that Karen had reached out to her to say that she had seen John O'Keefe kissing somebody else in the lobby of the hotel that they were staying at. She also mentioned that when she talked to Karen after John's body was found, Karen yelled into the phone, "John's dead." Next, the first responders testified about the scene when they first arrived. It was described as chaotic, and that John was laying face up with Karen trying to give him CPR. Karen had blood on her mouth from her attempts to perform CPR, and they said that Karen was just absolutely distraught, that she was screaming, and she was screaming that John wasn't breathing. They also described interactions with Karen. One firefighter testified that Karen repeatedly was saying, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him," when she was first asked about what had happened. Another officer testified that Karen said, "This is my fault. This is my fault. I did this." However, when cross-examined by the defense, they were able to get two police officers to acknowledge that they never actually heard Karen say that she hit John. They were also able to get two police officers to admit that they never saw broken pieces of taillight at the scene, which really goes to one aspect of why the defense believes that Karen Reed was framed. So like I said, court will be back in session today, and the trial is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks, with full days on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and then half days on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So we're going to follow this closely. I'm going to keep you updated. I think we might do what we did, or what we're doing, I should say, with Chad Daybell, where we're doing full weekly recaps of what's going down in the trial at the end of every week to catch you up, since I know it's difficult to not only even watch one full trial that's 40 hours a week, but now two. So if that's something you want, let me know, because we're trying to figure out, should we do it every week? Should we do it every 2 weeks? It feels like we should do it every week, because otherwise the information gets old and it's hard to keep up as you're checking in and out in a case. So I think we're going to do that starting next week. But again, let me know what you guys think and if that's something you want. Other than that, that is what we have going down this week in the true crime world. It has been a lot. I am happy that the rapist got castrated. That just, again, not to harp on it too much, it just makes me very, very happy. I feel like that should be the new rule of thumb for everybody. But I know I'm not going to be the only one that thinks that way, but I also know people probably won't agree with me on that, and that's okay. We are all allowed to have our own opinions. Other than that, we just launched merch. We are already sold out of quite a few items. So if you want to grab any of the new items, it's at annieelise.com. Very limited quantities available. So go snag it now. And hopefully we're not sold out by the time you go and check it out. And hopefully we won't be sold out by the time you check it out. But you can find all of that at annieelise.com. And that is what I've got for you. I will be back on the mic with you with an exclusive bonus episode ad-free this Friday. And then, of course, brand new Monday super mega deep dive. Guys, the Monday case is going to blow your mind. It is like, oh God, it's a roller coaster. It's a roller coaster. So I'll be back on the mic with you probably, what, the next few days. So just keep checking back. If you're not following the podcast yet, make sure you are, so that you don't miss any time these new episodes get uploaded. And that way you can fully be in the know and keep up with us. All right, guys, thank you so much for tuning into another episode. And until the next one, be nice, don't kill people, stay safe, and do all the things. All right, guys, talk to you soon. Bye.